Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Double Play Podcast. I'm Jack Smith, joined by my co-host Ryan Donahue, and a special guest. We're very honored to bring on current bench coach and offensive coordinator for the Texas Rangers, 2021 MLB Coach of the Year, Donnie Ecker. Donnie, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Yeah, glad to be here.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. We're very excited to talk a little baseball with you today. And if we want, we can get right into this one. To start this off, we're just going to kind of little warm up for you. We're going to give you some of the players that you've worked with, some of the hitters rather, and want you to kind of describe from your view, what's one kind of word or phrase that describes maybe their style of play or their personality behind the scenes. And we'll go ahead and start off with the jersey we talked about, Corey Seager.
Intense.
Intense. I like that.
How about Buster Posey?
Cerebral.
How about Joey Votto?
Machine.
Another one from Texas. How about Marcus Semien?
Detailed.
And then the last one, Giants guy, Jack's boy, Brandon Crawford.
Artistic.
Well, some of those guys that we mentioned are guys that you've gotten to work with more recently with the Rangers, because your front office has kind of been on a real war path the last couple of off seasons, shelling out a lot of money. How excited does it make you to see their commitment to winning and just the opportunity to work with some of the players they're bringing in, like Corey, like Marcus, like some of the other guys?
Yeah, I think you said it really well, Jack. There's kind of two parts. There's the rational side of, in my position, you know, our job is to go create solutions. So I don't put much energy on who I have. You know, the goal is to get those guys ready to perform. But I will say, when your ownership makes this type of move, right, it is, you don't ignore that. And we're a lucky, fortunate place. You're seeing this now at USC, where when leadership is aligned and we go all in, you can 10x your return on your investment really quickly. So ownership's all in here. They've made that commitment. It feels really good to be working at a place that is aligned from the top to the bottom and is willing to do that.
And then, I mean, you mentioned it's not necessarily about who the players are, but what you can do with them. And kind of one of the guys, not necessarily one of the big signings or big names, Nathaniel Lau last season kind of had a really big breakout year. Is there kind of like, is there anything that specifically that allowed him to break out from 2021 moving into a really great 2022?
Yeah, I think kind of macro, pulling back the curtain, the year before was his first year in the big leagues. Now we're playing 162 games, so he got a full season. And if you think of this as like a quarterback in college that's a freshman, he's going to get his 11 or 12 starts. That second year is usually more difficult because there's enough data now in the system where people schematically kind of know, like, you know, if we take this away, he'll struggle X, Y, Z. In baseball, they figure that out after about a month, you know, because we have so many at-bats. So, you know, there's a natural evolution here. And I think when I came in, it was one to learn Nate. Two was, hey, let's start really understanding how they want to attack you, and then we can reverse engineer a plan off that. So having some self-awareness of how defenses and how pitching wanted to attack him, we added clarity to that, figured out solutions. And then he's a very artistic guy. Like, he does photography when he goes to every stadium. He has a professional camera. So just making sure the way we talk to him, the way we train, the way we build his game plan and model, everything is almost through a lens, the way he takes a photo. So that's a big part of my job, is tapping into self-interest at the pro level, especially.
When you're mentioning those kind of chess moves where you're adjusting to what the pitchers are adjusting to, and then they adjust to the changes you make over an entire 162 game season, how many of those moves are there, and just how many adjustments do you have to make year to year? And does it get annoying when it's like, wow, the pitcher figured this one out kind of quick, and now we've got to go and figure out a new one before, you know, it's too late?
Yeah, it's probably one of the most overhyped things that doesn't actually exist. So, and here's what I'll say. Are there adjustments being made? Absolutely. But in the large sample of it, you know, 90%, 95% of each player's success is going to happen in similar general areas. right? So let's just, if we take the strike zone as 100%, 80% of that strike zone is usually where there's going to be a higher return of profit on a person's swing, right? If we think of every swing as a business decision, you know, similar to Caleb's not a good example because he could throw every single route, but there's a lot of quarterbacks that are very limited in their ability with what routes they can throw. And the best play callers put that guy in positions to throw those routes more often, right? Now, if you can open up your portfolio and have more solutions, both as a quarterback or as a hitter, that, I think that's where Nate evolved, and that's where the adjustments come in. Jack is like, okay, 80% of the time, this is your foundation. This is our personnel group. We're going to operate off this. Okay, now we're adding in some probabilistic thinking. He's able to sit on breaking balls in first pitch counts. Okay, he's able to sit on breaking balls with runners in scoring position. I think that's one thing you saw this year is he was a top five hitter on breaking balls with runners in scoring position. And a lot of that comes from obviously analytics and probabilistic thinking and then training it.
So, and you mentioned there's kind of most of your success comes from the one area. So then maybe in BP before a game or when you're training, are you kind of focusing on getting as good as you can at that? Or are you maybe focusing on what maybe you struggle with a little bit more and try and, okay, yeah, we already know you do this well. Let's try and do this well as well too.
Yeah, it's a fabulous question. Think of it as, let's say they're usually starting to walk in the cage around 2 o'clock for a 7 o'clock game. So think of like, we're going, our goal is to go wide to narrow with everything. The off season, our days, micro to macro, wide to narrow. So at 2 o'clock, we are building skill. So it's about technical, evolving and advancing our technique. So, hey man, like let's come in, let's work on moving better. Let's work on your bat path. We're priming the body to move fast. And then as you know, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock is shaping technique. They usually bounce. They'll come back. They have BP at a certain time. Let me get my charger in here. They'll have BP at a certain time around 5 o'clock. Then we have our game plan meeting like 5:30. After game planning meeting is when we kind of shift and we start narrowing the gap. And now we're thinking about, okay, we're facing Garrett Cole. He's got 22 inches of carry. He's got 4 inches of cut. Now we start focusing on what's our eye discipline tonight. You know, and you think of what are the best, what, why is Lincoln Riley so good? Why is Kyle Shanahan so good? They're so good because they create complexity underneath the most simple structures, but they do it with motions and formation. So, you know, it's called window dressing. So pitchers are doing the same exact thing. We're trying to have eye discipline so we don't get caught in a motion and we create a big play, right? So, so much of what I do does come from football, at least the way I think. But wide to narrow, we want to get to the point where after the game plan meeting, when they're kind of gearing up for the game, now we're replicating the exact shapes and metrics at like 6:15, 6:30, and they're locking in and they're owning their game plan. So the last thing they do is really like transferability to the game.
Now you mentioned players getting there around 2 o'clock. I read an article that you get there much earlier, especially for the night games. So I was just wondering, because I think most people tend to, you know, not exactly know what a bench coach does. I think it's less of a described position than say manager or pitching coach or something like that. What is your day-to-day when you're working with the Rangers in that position? Can you kind of like walk us through some of the more daily habits that you have when you get into the facility?
Yeah, sure. I'm usually there anywhere from like eight o'clock to 9 o'clock for a 7 o'clock game. And that first hour and a half is really just selfishly like me. It's, I get my workout in and I do the same thing every day, but I get my workout in. I make a iced coffee that I put protein vanilla in. So it's kind of like my vanilla latte without sugar. And then I go and I do a quick review. Once again, wide dinner. I do a quick review of last night and I kind of check our peripherals. And all those are is kind of like, what are our KPIs and our North Stars that we want to make sure we're staying on top of, right? So our chase rates, our walk rates, did we control home plate? You know, home plate for us, we call it the line of scrimmage and we have to own that every single night. So I just do a scan of like, objectively, what did we actually do? Now that it's the next day, there's no more emotion. What do we actually do peripherally? And then I just kind of have that in my mind. And then I shift to game planning for the starting pitcher that night. That typically will take anywhere from, you know, 2 to 3 hours to really build a plan. And a part of that is creating the video and creating the graphic designs of how we want to illustrate that in the game plan meeting. But I'll spend 2 or 3 hours on the game plan. and then I'll scrub that, and then I'll break it down individually. So wide to narrow, what does he like to do? Where is he having a success? Okay, what can we take away? And then how individually do I think it would be best for each guy to do that? So, you know, that gets me to like noon, 1 o'clock, and I usually grab a quick bite, and then players are starting to come in. And I just want to be mindful that when players are in the building, my face is not stuck in a computer. So that's why it's very important for me to get to the field early, go into the deep end, do the complex work, bring it up to the surface so it's really simple by the time they get there. And everything matters, the touch points, the experiences they have. So all information is up. We create touch points on TVs, on walls. Everything in that building is showing the game plan that day. So it's a way to create more repetitions. And then the guys start coming in, and then it's when the cage is getting going, then I shift my focus to the other team's opposing pitchers, the bullpen, how are they going to be managed? What was their usage? And I just start building a game plan for how we may pinch hit, what their manager may do. It's more the strategic side of making sure now that I'm supporting Bruce Bochy and the decisions he has to make. And that kind of takes me all the way to 5 o'clock, and I run the game plan meeting, and then we do another walkthrough. So as a hitting department, I'll sit down with my two assistants. We'll walk through. Here's what we three things. Well, here's what we expect to happen tonight. Let's make sure we're ready for it. Here's a couple possible speed bumps. And it's not bad stuff, but here's some outcomes that could happen. Here's how we'll pivot. And then the last thing is just understanding, like, you know, what do we think that the last three innings of the game is going to look like in terms of their usage? And we try to match that up, because the guys that are pinch hitting, it's not just like you're watching and you go hit. We're training. If they have an eighth inning sinker guy coming in, our guys are training because it's their matchup. We know that this left-handed hitter is going to face this right-handed sinker guy. So he's down there training for those exact pitch characteristics so he can go out and execute them.
Are there some pitchers that kind of you face that are harder to game plan for others, or you kind of maybe find yourself getting frustrated with, like, struggling to make a plan, maybe because the guy has a pitch that's so good or is just able to command the zone so well? Are there certain pitchers that you kind of find yourself maybe working harder than others for?
Oh, yeah. I go back to when I was a hitting coach for the Giants, and, you know, we had the best offense in baseball, and like in multiple ways, though. We walked the most, we chased the least, and we slugged the most. So that's really unique, right? That would be the football equivalent of, like, we pass more than anybody. We also run more than anybody, and we don't turn the ball over. Like we're you know, it's a really, really unique offense, the way we could attack people. It took us 7 times facing Walker Buehler before we scored more than 2 runs. Like, he dominated us, right? And I'll tell you why. And another guy dominated us, Merrill Kelly. And it took us 6 times before we kind of, it's not like we figured him out. We just had success against him. And the sticky stuff got banned in April. Okay, so context here. Walker Buehler, it made him better. He started throwing a sinker. He used to have a four-seam, a cutter, right? And then breaking balls. So everything was actually moving away to righties and into lefties. So the way I simplified that was, he has a four seam. Every single thing else is going to move horizontally away from you. Well, when they banned the sticky stuff, his cutter stopped playing as well. So he started throwing a sinker. It made him a totally different pitcher. And here's like the simplicity of it, is that when you can throw something in the same velocity range, 93 to 96, and it can go like this, and at the last second, it can go left or right. The thing about a fastball and a breaking ball is that it creates separation visually. So you can see the vertical separation of a breaking ball come off of a fastball, and you can adjust. This stays on a plane the whole time. That is the most difficult thing to prepare for, is when a guy has a four seam and a two seam, so multiple fastballs with a cutter. And it's literally the idea of it's literally like a Caleb Williams, right? Because it's like, it does not matter. You can have the perfect coverage, the perfect game plan. He's going to do enough things off script that you just have to wear it, you know? So he could throw his four seam and it could move this much, or it could go this way, a two seam. And you hope you're right in terms of what direction you're guessing.
I remember, I think it was on my birthday, that one start where you guys did finally get to Walker Buehler. I think it was Steven Duggar hit the triple. I think that was that one game. Well, actually, off that, yeah. Was that planned for? Like, he knew what opportunity he was going to get and he was working on what pitches, and did he just get that pitch, or was that one where this kind of worked out in your favor?
You know, his best pitch was his cutter all year. He would bust it into lefties. He'd throw it off the plate to righties. All year, we tried to avoid it. We said, we're going to take it. So if he starts the ball into a lefty, we're going to shut it down. We're going to wear his ass out and make him throw that pitch. Well, the pitch was so good that we would always swing and it would just blow us up. So I remember showing up to the field that day and we spent like 4 hours. We took a major deep dive into his analytics. And here's what we found out. We game planned on it. There was two particular counts where he was the best in baseball at creating chase. It was 1-1. So for whatever reason, 1-1 counts, he was getting, he had a 72% chase rate in 1-1 counts. So when you're manually doing this, you're filtering every single count and then you're sliding over and you're looking at chase rates and it's like 28, 27, 28, 72. It's like, oh my gosh. So then you click on that 72 and it plays every single pitch. And I had to manually write this out, and I'm writing cutter, cutter, cutter. Almost 90% of the pitches he threw in a 1-1 count were a cutter, right? And that can be a count just like 2-0. That was the next count for him where he gets in these counts where hitters are aggressive and he throws something that looks like a four seam and then it breaks last second. So we went through this whole process. The only time he gave up damage and slug was in 0-0 counts. So you're painting this picture, right? If you want to get him, you better get him on the first pitch when he's still in a strike. If you want to avoid his biggest trap, you better 1-1 counts, the cutter cannot beat you. And then 3-2, this is interesting. 3-2, his end zone rate, his ability to throw pitches in over the plate was 22%. So he's not throwing the ball over the plate 3-2 counts. Yet he had a 42% chase. Now this is because money. It is more, they would rather walk a guy and try to get a strikeout than make a mistake in zone and give up damage, right? There's no money. Who cares if he walks a guy, right? Because the chances, he's doing a great thing. I'm throwing the ball in zone 2 out of 10 times, and I'm getting people to almost swing half the time at it. So we sat there and we're like, we have no idea if this is going to work. That game was a massive game, if you remember. Mm-hmm. We're one game ahead of them, and that was in early September. It was our last series against them. So those are head-to-head matchups. Duggar had that. If you remember, Duggar hits the cutter. Craw hits an 0-0 double down the line. It gets us the lead. So the game plan was slug 0-0. We're going to go. Like, we're going to be aggressive. We're taking our shots. Who cares? We're looking to hammer 0-0. We're going to shrink the zone as small as we can on 1-1, and we're going to take all night on 3-2 counts. So we had three doubles and 0-0 counts. We chase one pitch in a 1-1 count and we walk three times by literally nobody would know this until now, but we were auto taking. We just took our chances. He threw three times. So you go back and watch that game. It's fun to like look at. And the announcers, I remember the announcers like, that's a great take. And he doesn't know that we were just taking the pitch.
That's awesome.
So yeah, we got it. I think we got him for like 5 or 6 runs and knocked him out in the second inning. And then I think he kind of dominated us in the playoffs again.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, that was fun to watch all year because I Jack and I were talking about it. The 2021 Giants were just so improbable. You guys just kept winning. I was like, oh, it's going to slow down. It's going to slow down. It's just they never did. 107 games or whatever. So how kind of magical was that season to watch on the inside? And was it almost as much of a shock to you as it was to us almost, or was it like, we know these guys can do what they're doing and they just went out and did it because of the game plan? Or
yeah, we didn't know how good we were until about June, to be honest, you know, because the team had very little expectations externally. Internally, you know, the key to that whole team was Buster Posey. He's a unique competitor that connects people and holds people accountable in a healthy way. So we just, as cliche as it sounds, like, we were obsessed with our preparation and we're going to go let it rip during the game, trust our game plan, go let it rip. And we just kind of did that. You go through April and you're like, hey man, we're like, you know, 15-10, pretty good. Then you go through May and you do it again. It's like, I remember we got swept by the Dodgers at home the first series in April. And the sticky stuff, and it was crazy. And we had a very ball control offense, right? We didn't swing that much. We walked a ton, we'd wear you out, and then we'd catch mistakes and we'd damage you. We pivoted our offensive approach against the Dodgers the rest of the season because what the Dodgers did, they were our antidote, right? They didn't walk people, and their pitches behaved at a higher quality than anybody else. So their fastball characteristics, all their pitches perform better. So when the Dodgers faced us, they said, well, what are the Giants doing? What are they trying to do to you? Well, we're trying to take pitches that are out of the zone so we can walk and create traffic and create scoring opportunities. So the Dodgers said, well, we're not going to waste our time throwing out of the zone. We're going to throw our best stuff in the zone and see if you can hit it. And we got into 0-2 counts all night long in that series, and they beat our ass. So we coined it, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm just pissed. Like this, we can't play our normal offense against the Dodgers, right? Because they counter it really well. So we're sitting there and it's like, we're going to call it the fast break offense. And we play them about 3 weeks, a month later. And the whole idea was like, we have to operate. Our offense was at its best when we were swinging between 40 and 46% of the time. So pretty selective. We coined it like, hey, it's fast break offense. We're going to try to swing 80% of the time. We're going to ambush them early. We're going to go. Now, we never swung 80% of the time, but it was a mentality that when we faced the Dodgers, we had to beat them in the zone. We were never going to look up and say, hey, we drew six walks against the Dodgers and this. Like, they would not let it happen. They were so disciplined with it. So we went back to LA 3 weeks later. We scored 5 runs in the first off Urias, 4 runs off Bauer. Like, we swept them at home, and like everything kind of changed off that. And we got to June and we're still doing the same thing, winning 15, 20 games a month. And, you know, believe it or not, you almost earn the right to know, like, hey man, we can play with everybody. And then it just kind of took off. But I'll say Buster Posey with 2 weeks left in the season, right before the game, he kind of had the same routine. We were right next to each other, and he goes, man, I've never experienced anything like this. I'm looking at him like he's won 3 World Series, right? He's going to be a Hall of Famer. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, this is incredible. He's like, this is exhausting and I love it. I'm like, tell me, like, what are you talking about? He's like, I've looked at that scoreboard out there in the standings for 2 months now, and we've never had more than 2 game advantage up or down than the Dodgers. We played the last 67 games with the division within 2 games. So every single night, it felt like a must win. And so for Buster Posey to say that, I don't have perspective. I was in my 3rd year in the big leagues. And to me, you know, Buster's 3 World Series, Rookie of the Year, Hall of Fame, MVP. And he's like, I've never experienced anything like this. So I have that in the back of my head of how unique that was. And it was really cool that we got to finish it and finish it at home and win that division.
I don't think Ryan gave you enough credit. He's a Dodgers fan, so he didn't want to believe that you guys could beat them for the division. But I was a little bit more of a believer when it came down to, because you guys were all the way down to the wire the last game of the season. It was a win and you win the division. Can you take us through what happened in game 162? And I'm curious if you take any credit for Logan Webb's home run. Are you teaching the pitchers the same way to hit as everyone else?
Not at all, man. Logan can hit and he loves it. And he trains. He practiced a lot for that moment, which is cool. But I think the last game of the year was business as usual. Like, we showed up. Everybody knows, you know, we don't lie about it, but everybody knows what's at stake. And you go back into, let's prepare. It was a 1 o'clock game, so it's a quick morning. I think the important thing that we talked about that day was, as silly as this sounds, let's make sure the music is good in the cage, just have the vibe good, and let's make the game plan meeting a little bit lighter and fun. So we had a lot more, like, we played a video from The Office, and then we talked about, you know, how we're going to face San Diego, and just kept it light. I think it was important to keep it light. And, you know, I believe we separated the score really early when we were up quite a bit. It was, you know, it's a good feeling to have.
Kind of one thing that you mentioned for me was, I mean, you talk about, we know it's so close in the division, you're always feeling like it's a must win, but is there a point where you're like, keep winning, you're keeping it close? How big of a factor is momentum in that? And kind of as you keep winning, and even as the whole season went on, when you're still in first place, July, August, is there like, we can do this? Like, how big is confidence and momentum just like throughout a season? And then even through ups and downs, like, when you're hitting well, it feels like, I mean, we always hear the guy thinks the ball is a beach ball. So like, is that a real thing? Like when guys are hot, they just can't be stopped, and conversely with the lows as well.
Yeah, I mean, it is, right? There's a flow state, a feeling that these guys get into, and it's really important when they're in it that you really understand that, and you almost try to like give them space, like let them ride it out a little bit, you know? The confidence, you know, it's a word that's thrown around a lot. I think it's a dangerous word that's misused. It's kind of been hijacked. Like, you know, the way I think about confidence is, you can be confident in this moment and not be confident in this next moment, you know, and that's okay. But I think what happens is there's some filters to confidence that I believe in, which is like, do I know what to do? Do I know how to do it? And there's a couple more pieces, like, am I capable of doing it? And then that last thing is like, have I done this before? And so when you go, you know what we have to do, you know how to do it. That team evolved into like, man, we're capable of doing this because we showed it. And then when you keep doing it over and over, right? Like the first time you run a 2-minute drill in college or the NFL, like you're probably not as good and not as confident with yourself as like the 10th time or when Tom Brady does it now, right? So that team just grew so much that we had incredible confidence by July, August, September. And momentum was real, but it really felt like you were in the playoffs and you were must win. I mean, early August. And you know what? I remember talking to Robert Von Skoyak, the Dodgers hitting coach, because you're not worried about what other people are thinking. But I remember him telling me, you know, a year later, he's like, every day we just looked up and was like, God, they won't lose. And he goes, it exhausted us, which was really interesting, you know, to like think about. You know, everyone says like, don't watch the scoreboard, don't do that. Like, no, everybody does. It's okay. Like that's the truth, right? Like some games we can say like, this game's not any bigger than the other. Like, well, yeah, like it is. And it is because our players think that way. So it's really important to like numb that, speak truth into it, and then just, you know, be honest about it and then kind of get back to your preparation. And we all know how this ends, so I'll just say it before you do, Ryan. Like they came into San Francisco and knocked us out of the playoffs, and it was they had the last laugh.
Well, I mean, even though they had the last laugh, you talk about it was exhausting. It hurt them in the next series. They couldn't go and beat the Braves after that.
That's what they said. Yeah, it was our series all year long. We're just a little bit more emotion, a little bit more into it, and we kind of wore down the bullpen, and we never got the big hit in that series. Our peripherals, it's super interesting. That was our second best series from a process standpoint that we did all year. So when you think about, imagine playing a 5-game series in college football and you throw for 310, you run for 120, you don't turn the ball over once and you lose 3 out of 5, you know. We had a 9% walk rate. We chased 22% in the whole series. We almost hit 50% of our balls over 95 miles an hour. So it just, you don't want to say the word unlucky, but we did really good process things, but we never got the big hit.
I feel like up until the Cody Bellinger hit at the end of the game, it felt like both sides were like that almost, or just neither side could get the big hit. And the pitching was so good in that series as well with Logan, even, and Max Scherzer. There's so many great pitchers in that series. I'm curious, as something you mentioned, where if a player's slumping, sometimes you just let him ride it out. Is that the main way that you would go about handling a player in a slump, or do they sometimes come to you and ask for more hands-on helping them fix it? I'm just curious about what your philosophy is helping a player out of a slump.
Okay, a slump, yeah. So I was more saying when he's really rolling.
Okay. We'll kind
of be conscientious of that. Like, let's just keep him flowing. But when he's slumping, it goes back to like, did we do the work on the front end? So everything from, you know, before the season even starts, every year I go through the same process, but hey, what do you want out of this year? We drive things through self-interest. Now I'm in year 2 with guys. I know when they break down. Like, I know what ticks Corey Seager off. I know what makes Marcus Semien go. So you know these guys so well that, like, we don't really use the word slump. But if we know somebody's not at their best and they're kind of steering away, how do we get them back? So that's just all relationships and trust. Like, it's usually not technique driven. It's usually either let's bring awareness to something. So some common things show up that get guys off track. One is you can run into a spell where you get a couple bad umpires and they're calling balls off the plate like this. And then you start changing your game plan. You're swinging too much. That's one of the most common things that happens, that we just have to use the data and say, hey man, nothing's wrong. Your swing frequency is now shifting to their location frequency, and it's not where you do well. So let's just tighten it up. Let's get back to what we do really well. That's probably the thing that happens the most, is so that's the human element that's kicking in on the human element of umpires that we have to deal with. And then typically it's like off the field stuff that's going on. And it's just our job to set up the environment to make sure we take care of each individual, right? And as a whole, we're healthy. But there are some times, man, where a guy's really going through it. And I prefer to just go up and like, hey man, like, let's just go on a walk. Like, we'll just walk and talk and just kind of let them vent, let them get it out, and then add some perspective to it.
So you usually find in those type of cases, it's more of the human element, the mental side, like kind of maybe the, how they're not as confident in themselves in that time, rather than maybe a change that they need to make at the plate.
Yeah, I mean, we've definitely done both, right? Yeah. But I'll just say that our every day, right, in our stadium, we have limb tracking. So it's tracking every single angle from a knee to a hip to a spine. So we've tested guys in lab, like we know biomechanically when our guys are at their best moving. I know if when Corey Seager's bat is behind his helmet at a certain angle, he's going to get the ball off the ground. I know when it gets flat and like, so we have actionable items that come out every single morning that keep us on track when a guy's getting, oh man, you're striding 6 inches longer today than you were when you were going well. So the actual physical part, we have that automated to a really high level of like analytically. That never strays too far off. It's mostly about getting them back. The thing we still can't measure is we can't measure the emotions. We can't measure the mindset. We can't measure the human element that comes in. So we have to be so damn good at making sure we're focused on that.
You mentioned Corey. I think he's a player that a lot of people point to that might be a beneficiary of the limited shift coming this upcoming season. I'm curious as to what your perspective is on some of these changes that might be coming to baseball. Now look at the shift this year. You mentioned umpires could be seeing robotic umpires in the next couple of years. I'm just curious what your opinion is of those, and will those change the way that you approach teaching hitting?
Yeah, great question. I get asked this a lot. Forever, I hope I stay this way, but I'm less concerned with what the rules are, like how I feel about them. And I'm way more concerned with how we can use them to our favor to create advantages, right? So you can complain about up tempo, no huddle, or you can complain about all this stuff, less miles, or you can, you know, Nick Saban before he got beat by Lawrence and Deshaun, and then he's like, well, let's go hire Lane and let's actually do this. So you don't complain about them, figure out what the rules are, and then help your players get the most out of those rules. So Corey was one of the guys that hit the ball the hardest between certain angles that will now be a hit. I think it's like almost around 20 or 25 extra hits that he's going to benefit from. So it's a big deal. Yeah, we're thinking about all of that. We're thinking about automated strike zone. We're thinking about the bases being bigger. How does that change our leadoffs, the pitch clock? So we have to practice and change our routines in between pitches, because they're going to call some guys in the minor leagues they struck out on violations, you know, so guy has 1 foot in the box, the umpire does his dance and says strike three. And it's so we have a lot that we need to practice and train based on these new rules.
Yeah. I mean, that's going to be something that I've been kind of thinking about a little bit. I feel like we're going to have some guys that we might not expect to have great seasons kind of benefit from getting rid of the shift. So that's going to be an interesting development this season. And kind of what you mentioned all these analytics guy, you sound like a very big analytic database guy. What's kind of, how does that kind of change all your approaches teaching hitting and teaching guys? Are all guys kind of adopting the analytics, or some guys a little bit more old school kind of struggle, and like they're, I'm trying to word this here, but
Yeah, no, I know what you're saying. I'll help you. Everybody's connected to different things, right? It's just back to learning styles and human beings. So as much as I'm driven analytically, it's just been so overcooked. You know, are you going to be more efficient in the grocery store if you write a list before you go in or without a list? Like, that's analytics to me. Like, am I a better coach when I know exactly what they do well and what they don't do well? Like, yeah. So it's funny to see the people that get over emotional and they create this divide between old school and new school. It's like, dude, what does that even mean? How about, are you a better coach if you have objective information than without? You are. Like, it makes you very responsible. The best coaches in the world that I'm seeing right now, they can take objective information, they can stick it in their back pocket, and they can blend it and know how to disperse it to each individual based on their learning style. So that's what I try to do. And it's just back to, you think about the work you do in the beginning, which is, hey man, like, what do you want for this season? You just ask them that. Nobody says, I want to be average, I want to strike out a lot. Like, nobody says that. They usually, like, they're going for it. Okay, then let's build a plan for that. Some guys like Brandon Crawford, he was an entire swing change. So we had to be a little bit more tech driven to show him objectively how he's going to create more force if we do this with his back kick or this with his bat. Right. And it was, when players see that and you're not guessing on them, do you know, like, that creates such a level of trust that they appreciate. And then that's just the beginning. Now the human element of actually the art of how we're going to, like, transform these skills and how we're going to work on this and connect to that, now it kicks in. So my overall just, like, principle with that is, am I better if I have more resources in my back pocket than if I don't? Absolutely. Like, the more things I can pull out based on who needs what, I feel like I'm able to serve people better.
I feel like when most people, the casual people, talk about analytics, of course, they don't know about the limb measuring that occurs in every stadium. What they see as analytics is just talking about, you know, batting average or OPS plus. And I think there's the big debate about, like, what stats are actually good at capturing the effectiveness of hitters. And I know you guys use probably more advanced stuff than the fans do or broadcasts do. But if you had to make it just one or two, like, what stats do you think specifically capture, you know, actual hitter success, whether they be, you know, analytical stats or some of the older stats?
Yeah. My favorite one as an offense is runs scored, right? It's 100% analytically. We've still never seen a team lose if they have more runs.
Yeah.
Or more points. Yet to see it. So my last two interviews for my last two jobs, they've asked me to, like, do this big presentation on what's my favorite metric. And I literally put one slide up. It's like, run scored. That's the goal, right? The goal is to put the ball in the end zone. The goal is to score. So as far as offensively, I love expected WOBA. So expected WOBA, some of those numbers, because they're telling you how hard you're hitting the ball, what angles you're hitting the ball at, what you're swinging at, what you're not swinging at. It kind of gives you a whole overall picture of the overall profile. So I really love that number. I think a more strict number, OPS, really tells you the value of a hitter. And so then you get a little bit of, like, Billy Bean, old school, like, does he get on base? Then you get slugging, you kind of combine that. You have on base plus slugging. The best hitters, you look up and their OPS is, you know, 750 to 900. And those are the guys that walk a ton and they slug a ton. And it's as simple as that. And a lot of people that we put on a pedestal, you know, it's like, oh my God, it's like Brandon Sosna. We were talking about this. Did you ever have a chance to meet Brandon?
I haven't. Not. No, I did not. Because
Brandon's on Mount Rushmore at USC, right? For, like, going and getting Lincoln and all that. And it's like, I wish they would know that he's one of the most analytically driven and responsible human beings, like, ever in our field. And it's like, if you knew the algorithms he built that determined that he should hire Luke Fickell in Cincinnati, it's like, would you feel the same about him if you knew that? But it's like, behind the scenes, these top decision makers that are especially, you know, your guys' age to mine, these guys aren't guessing. These guys they're walking into a room and they already have, like, hey, like, you know, 82% of the time you created the cells, you know, or like Q1, you did this. And they just have that. It just adds a layer of responsibility. And I do, it's kind of a hope for mine of sports, and is, you know, if something comes out of our mouth, we have to own that, you know, it has to mean something. So I tell our whole department, that our 8 hitting coaches, we're not going to be an environment that just says, like, this guy's elite at that. Well, no, like, time out. Like, what does that mean? Like, he's an elite hitter, but he's striking out 45% A ball. Like, those. So we just try to add a really high layer of responsibility for doing your homework on that.
I would say to all the people in our comment section who would say, you know, why are you using these advanced stats? You have right now an award-winning MLB coach telling you that that's the way that things are trending and the way that you're not guessing. You talk about Billy Bean. Are you a Moneyball fan? Do you like other baseball movies? Like, what's your favorite one?
I love things that stood the test of time. So as much as if you're in the chat talking about that I'm new school or something, like, what stood the test of time is people that are able to use information to empower their decisions, right? So Billy Bean, what stood the test of time is it's really freaking valuable to get to first base. Like, you get to first base, you go to second, third, home, you score, right? So they identified this a long time ago. There's value in creating scoring opportunities, right? Now getting to home plate is different. It's like the way we think about quarterbacks. There are guys that are good between the 20s. And there are guys, when they get in the red zone, they're just difference makers, right? Caleb Williams, difference maker. Like, you're not going to kick many field goals, but there's a lot of quarterbacks, you know, Alex Smith, like some of those guys, they're good between the 20s and the game shrinks. So you're trying to do both. You know, Houston Astros, they are so good between the 20s. They're so good at getting guys at first base, and they are also elite at getting the ball in the end zone, right? They're so versatile. And that goes from what they acquire to what they scout and how they develop. They're so aligned with all those three systems.
Is there a player kind of past or present that you see that kind of does something so well and you're like, oh, I wish I had the chance to work with that player, and kind of why a certain player and kind of what they did so well that you like?
Probably Barry Bonds. Because there's not many hitters where I look back generations and I think, oh, he could hit in today's game. You know, it's a very unpopular take, but right now we love comparing. You know, we're like, Pete Rose would have hit 450 in today's game. And it's like, the average fastball was 90 miles an hour. You know, and all you have to do is ask the guys that are playing right now and ask the guys that played like 10 years ago, and they come and they say the same thing. They're like, oh my God, every single person is throwing 97 to 100, right? So I don't like comparing, because Pete Rose would have had today's resources to prepare himself and to train himself, right? So who knows what he could do. But Barry Bonds is the guy for me. His power, his quality of his bat path, the way he moved. I just think Barry could play right now. If he's back in his prime right now, and he would be one of those top hitters in the game by far. He can hit breaking balls. Like, he'll walk. He's the perfect player in today's game.
Well, I mean, lucky for you, you get to work with a different San Francisco legend, Bruce Bochy, obviously taking over as the manager of the Rangers. How has that been so far? And just overall, what are you looking for working with him that you guys need to do to be successful in 2023?
Yeah, wisdom, right? I mean, I went and bought a notebook just for him. So anything he says, I just want it in a separate notebook. So there's an age of information where we're so good at consuming information that we're like confusing wisdom with intelligence. What Bochy has is wisdom, which is he's consumed information, but he knows how to use it and when to use it. And that's been a treat, man. Like, just a lot of the stuff he says, I can't get in a computer. So it's been a treat. He's been there. He's done that. Just really looking forward to learning from him.
And kind of, how much of the preparation that you're doing now will impact your success going forward? And do you attribute maybe a successful season more to how you execute during the season? Or is it a lot of what's going on behind the scenes? Like, while fans are in the off season, you're still working, kind of preparing for this upcoming season. Where do you think success comes from? How do you be successful in such a long season, 162 games?
Yeah, I mean, every day you're trying to be as competitive as you can in terms of, you know, outfit a competitive team, build a competitive game plan, and then just go play it. It's such a long season that you truly do just need to take it day by day. We know that this is like everybody else, right? It's about winning the World Series. So you know that it's the invisible handshake. And then, you know, the thing that actually gets you there is kind of being immersed into the journey. So even today, I'm not worried about, you know, my whiteboard right here has one phrase on it. It says discipline is the shortcut. So like even that tells me I can't be day one of spring training right now. Today I have two player plans that I need to work on, and that's what I need to do to be the best I can be for the guys. So it's being present and just being locked in that day, making sure you're able to help guys, and just the scoreboard takes care of itself.
Yeah, well, we wish you luck in 2023. It's been really great to get to learn some of this stuff, whether it's learning some history from the Giants-Dodgers rivalry or just the philosophy about hitting. I think we're going to enjoy it. Of course, people that listen are really going to enjoy it, and we're really thankful that you were able to come on.
Well, man, appreciate you guys.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, thank you so much.